Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is episode 21 of what was going to be 20 episodes in the history of the Catholic Church. It looks like it's going to be more, 22 or 23, but today we're going to be looking at the 19th century from 1800 to 1900, and to, as I've done before, we need to go backtrack a little bit in order to put this particular century into context. We have to remember in the 18th century, the church is coping with a couple of different forces. One is the forces of aristocracy and monarchy who are quarreling with themselves and fighting amongst themselves for dominance in Europe. But at the same time, philosophically, we have the rise of the Enlightenment, and on the back of that comes the rise of the revolutionary movements, which are bringing in humanism and secularism, and it all comes to a climax in the late 18th century with, of course, the French Revolution, which ends in bloodshed for the church and the establishment of a pagan humanistic religion, closing down the churches, murdering the clergy and the religious, and bringing a terrible upheaval and terrible bloodshed to France, and near destruction of the Catholic Church. Also, during the 18th century, the Catholic Church had experienced a series of weak popes, popes that had mostly been elected by the different political powers, and therefore were compromisers and were weak popes. And so by the end of the 18th century, you could have said that the Catholic Church was pretty much washed up. Not only in France, the revolution had been the strongest and the most bloodthirsty, but the same currents of revolution and of taking over the church's power and wealth and property was happening all across Europe. The monarchs, the royal families of Europe were also encroaching on the church by claiming the power to appoint bishops, claiming the wealth of and the income from the church, confiscating the properties of the church, so that by the end of the 18th century, the church was in a terrible situation. Well, the French Revolution, of course, produces this character, Napoleon, and Napoleon emerges from the French Revolution looking for a way to unite France and to unite the French together around him and around the empire which he wishes to establish. In 1796, he marches on Italy and claims the northern part of Italy, but he does not actually march on Rome. But in 1797, a pontifical guard murders a French soldier, and that's an excuse for Napoleon to march on Rome. He takes Pope Pius VI prisoner and marches him north so that the Austrians, who are the other major political and military power, can't rescue Pius VI and restore him to the papacy. Well, Pius VI is an old man, and he dies in the journey. Pius VII is elected. Now, Pius VII is a very interesting pope because he's a Benedictine monk. And Napoleon probably thinks that he's a bit of a softy or a pushover. And Napoleon realizes that he needs to unify France. And so he comes up with the idea that the French can be reunited. And to do this, they need to have a their shared religion. He wants to restore the Catholic Church. So he sends one of his agents, go to Rome and tell the Pope I want to give him 30 million Frenchmen. He comes to an agreement called a concordat with Pope Pius VII. And in this agreement, he resolves the schism that had occurred in the French Church between those who had conformed to the secular government and those who had not. And he also establishes an agreement with the Pope that the Pope retains the Papal States. And Napoleon will appoint the bishops, but the Pope will consecrate them and institute them into their diocese. And this agreement is established, and everything seems to be going well. But then Pope Pius VII, defying all kind of expectations and predictions, actually stands up to Napoleon. Napoleon gradually is trying to take over more and more power in the church, and Pius VII resists him. Napoleon, furious by this, goes to Rome, takes Pius VII prisoner, and marches him up to France and keeps him a prisoner for 6 years. Now, what I love about this is that Pius VII had been a Benedictine monk, so he knew how to live in austerity. And he may have been sorry to give up his palaces and his wealth of being the Pope, but he seems to have done pretty well in captivity, because he goes back to being an ordinary monk. And he makes his own bed, mends his own clothes, and lives a life of austerity and prayer and study, as he would have done as a monk. And he sort of holds out and continues to resist Napoleon. And Napoleon goes and tries to bully the Pope and tries to actually harangue him and get him to conform. And Pius VII holds out against him. And then the tables are turned. And in 1815, Napoleon is defeated, both in his Russian campaign and then at Waterloo by the British. The Pope is set free, and he returns to Rome as a kind of conquering hero. And this victory of the Pope, Pope Pius VII, actually is one of the key factors which makes for an amazing return and a startling comeback of the Catholic Church in the 19th century. We can summarize it like this. The era that began with the downfall of Napoleon witnessed a full-scale revival of the Catholic Church, a spiritual and intellectual renaissance that made it once more a vital institution and a powerful force in public affairs. It was an amazing reversal. The revolutionary period saw the church stripped of its privileges, its pope imprisoned, its property confiscated, its monasteries emptied, its priests and nuns slaughtered and driven into exile, and the church's very existence was in question. And even though it was propped up for a while by Napoleon, he treated it badly. He humiliated the pope, considered the bishops to be his servants, and he even rewrote the church's catechism and tried to dictate the discipline that it was to follow. Even at one point, he tried to establish the feast of Saint Napoleon in the church's calendar. But after his defeat, it was the heroic refusal of Pius VII to bend the knee to Napoleon that won the admiration of all of Europe. And at the Congress of Vienna, after the defeat of Napoleon, peace was established for Europe for 100 years, and the Pope regains the Papal States and establishes the foundation for great prestige. Now, the other thing which happened to contribute to the comeback of the Catholic Church was a great reaction amongst the people of Europe against the terrors of the French Revolution and the horrors of revolution. The monarchies across Europe began a conservative swing back, and they kept at bay the forces of revolution, and the papacy, of course, was part of that conservative pushback. And so an intellectual movement grew up as well, a spiritual movement in which the forces of the papacy and the monarchy, the different monarchies of Europe, established the old way of doing things and pushed back against the forces of revolution. One of the things that was happening was also the resurgence of missionary efforts. The Pope Pius reestablished the Jesuit order. Different religious orders sprang up. This is the time of the Curé d'Ars, St. John Vianney, who brings a new piety and a new passion to the local clergy and to the local people. New devotions spring up all across Europe. And there's a genuine spiritual renewal and a genuine revival of the church in the 19th century, which is one of the triumphs, which is swings back against the tragedies that we'd seen in the 18th century. Now, during this time period as well, one of the intellectual movements which is going on is an intellectual movement of liberalism. And liberalism is very difficult to pin down because it has lots of different... It's a monster with lots of different heads. There's an intellectual liberalism, which is based in the philosophy of the Enlightenment, the philosophy of humanism, the philosophy of secularism, and basically saying that we're here to make this world a better place. With the rise of scientism and technology as part of this, and it undermines any kind of supernatural understanding of the world. This intellectual movement has a theological dimension, so that the theologians of the time period, the liberal theologians of the time period, are trying to do away with the supernatural dimension and bring in a Christianity which is humanistic, which is more concerned about changing this world than to be concerned about the next world. It's one which is reinterpreting the Bible as well. Biblical criticism grows up now and begins to examine whether the Bible is true the way it's always been thought of as true. It's trying to get rid of superstition. It's trying to get rid of the miraculous element to the Bible stories. And along with this intellectual and theological trend of liberalism, there is, of course, a political aspect to it. This is during the rise of the United States and the rise of democracy, the rise of human rights. This is the time when people are beginning to call for freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of speech. And the conservative forces in Europe, including the papacy, are dead set against all these freedoms, which they see part of the revolutionary zeal that they're reacting against, which had caused such havoc in Europe in the 18th century. Along with the theological and the political and the intellectual streams of liberalism, there is, of course, the revolutionary economic stream, which is calling for economic revolution. There's also the technological innovations. This is the time of the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the steam train and the telegraph and all of the progress that's made technologically during the 19th century is all part of this liberalizing movement, and the church and the papacy is standing up against it. But there's a French theologian called Lamennais, and Lamennais decides that the church, instead of being against the modern world and against all of the progress that's going on, says no, the church should actually be part of it and should embrace it and should see what's good about it and baptize it and try, if possible, to work with the forces of liberalism instead of against them. And so Lamennais is a very idealistic and a very naive theologian, really. He goes to the Pope, who by this time is Pope Gregory the 16th, and by the 1830s, he's wanting to go to the Pope with a proposal, a memorandum, which they submit to the Pope in 1831, asking the Pope Gregory to embrace liberalism and to actually bring the church into the modern age by working with the liberals. By 1832, the Pope had finally made his response, and it was an encyclical letter, Mirari Vos, which turned out to be a scathing denunciation of any idea that the church should accommodate itself to Catholicism. He goes through and rejects the separation, rejects the separation of church and state. He denounces the liberty of conscience as madness. He refers to the liberty of press as abominable and detestable. And he demands unqualified submission to his encyclical and trying to root out all forces of liberalism from the church altogether. Well, Lamennais and others try to find ways to tiptoe around the Pope's harsh demands and see if they can accommodate, but eventually they leave the church and they can't work with liberal and in favor of liberalism. Meanwhile, Rome sees in liberalism two main errors: a rejection of supernatural revelation and religious indifferentism. In other words, the idea that it doesn't really matter what religion you follow as long as you obey your conscience. Well, the forces of liberalism continue to bubble away below the surface in Europe in all these different ways. On the other hand, the conservatives want the church to declare all-out war against the liberalism, because they see it as part of the French Revolution coming back again, but in a way which is trying to be more amenable. So we see the forces of liberalism in the church today really beginning to take the root, and this struggle beginning back in the middle of the 19th century, in the 1830s. And we see that those forces of liberalism in the church, of course, had their roots earlier in the Enlightenment and in the revolutionary period of the 18th century. So we're seeing these different forces come up in the 19th century, and it's important to take time to actually understand them, because these forces are going to be the forces that then come through into the 20th century and into our own time period today. Well, Gregory the 12th is succeeded by Pope Pius the 9th. Pius the 9th is elected in 1846, and he is first embraced as a liberal, and they think that he's going to be a modernizing pope. And indeed, he starts out by establishing a parliament for the Papal States, something which had never been heard of before, and he brings in various reforms, and everybody thinks he's going to be this reforming pope. But his parliament declares war on Austria. This is why. At the same time, the forces for Italian unification are beginning. These are the forces to unite the entire Italian peninsula in one political body. And so therefore, the Pope's parliament in the Papal States in central Italy decide to declare war on Austria to drive them out of Italy so that Italy can be united. The Pope says, Pope Pius IX says, you can't declare war on your fellow Catholics. And he immediately, Pope Pius IX, therefore, goes from being a very popular pope in Italy to being a very unpopular pope. And there's riots in Rome, and he actually has to escape in disguise as an ordinary priest. And he rallies his forces and then returns to Rome, and he is therefore dead set after that against all forces of revolution, all forces of liberalism, all forces of modernism. And Pius IX, therefore, as the longest reigning pope, who reigns for, I think, over 30 years in the middle of the 19th century, is known, therefore, as the great pope against modernism. Pius IX, also known as Pio Nono, is on the one hand a very popular personality. He's a friendly person. He's genial. He wanders through the streets of Rome. He's very popular amongst the people, but he's very unpopular amongst the liberals, because he establishes his famous Syllabus of Errors in 1864, which is his great document against all of the errors of modernism. And he holds out against the errors of modernism, not only through his writing, but also by being a pope for so long. He dominates the episcopate. He appoints his men as bishops and cardinals, and holds out firmly against all forms of liberalism and all forms of modernism in the church. He is then succeeded by Pope Leo XIII. And Pope Leo XIII is also a conservative, but he puts a friendlier face on conservatism. During the same time period, the forces of liberalism are coming together across Europe, and the great figure of John Henry Newman, the English cardinal, also takes the side of the liberals, not completely, but in as much as he wants the church to relate to the modern age, and he wants the church to try to connect with the modern age that he sees emerging. And he doesn't see it as a path of wisdom to simply retreat behind the battlements and take pot shots at the modern age. Newman thinks there should be dialogue, and thinks there should be some way to bring the Catholic truth into the modern age, and he fights for that on the side of the liberals, and he's very suspected, therefore. Well, Pius IX not only establishes this strong papacy and sees it as the salvation of the church in an age of godless, anti-Christian, anti-clerical liberals. But he also establishes and promotes this idea of ultramontanism. Ultramontanism is a word simply for hyper-papalism, to really elevate the papacy higher than it's ever been before. Now, this is the ironic thing, that in the 18th century, the papacy was almost defeated completely, and the Pope was taken prisoner and was held prisoner for 6 years, and now suddenly, within 50 years or so, there's this complete reversal, and the papacy reaches a new height of power and a new height of influence that it never had before. It's during this time period that we see the declaration of the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and this is declared by the Pope, who reads the document out, surrounded by all of his bishops, in this great statement of doctrinal authority, the like of which has never been seen before, and Pope Pius IX also is the Pope who begins to establish, under whom the great conflict about papal infallibility is established. We don't have time to go into all the details about the First Vatican Council, but it's established by Pope Pius IX. And in addition to the declaration of the Immaculate Conception in December of 1854, this is also the period, of course, of Marian apparitions. The Marian apparitions of the Miraculous Medal to St. Catherine Labore in 1830. That's followed in 1846 by the apparitions to the children at La Salette. This is followed in 1858 by the apparition to St. Bernadette at Lourdes. And this is just 4 years after the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception has been declared by Pope Pius IX. So this is an amazing age in which not only is Marian devotion growing, but also the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And the big Basilica of the Sacré Cœur, the Sacred Heart in Paris, is built during this time period as a declaration of this resurgence of Catholic triumphalism in the middle of the 19th century. The last couple of things we need to mention before we go into Pope Leo XIII at the end of the century is also the First Vatican Council, which establishes the doctrine of papal infallibility. There was a huge conflict back and forth over this doctrine. Many of the cardinals and the bishops resisted, and they put qualifications. Meantime, the ultramontanists, the hyper-papalists, were pushing for this definition of papal infallibility. And ironically, the doctrine of papal infallibility was finally voted on and declared in 1870. It was during the midst of a tremendous thunderstorm, which was memorable with lightning and thunder and rain crashing down on the dome of St. Peter's, in which this vote went through, and the doctrine of papal infallibility was established. And ironically, it was in 1870, just the same year that the doctrine of papal infallibility was established, that the forces of Italian nationalism swept into Rome and the Pope lost the papal states. And so finally in 1870, the Pope loses his kingdom, loses his geographical territory, and with an agreement with the new Italian government, he is granted the Vatican State, and he's granted certain diplomatic rights, and Castel Gandolfo, and his geographical territory is limited only to this small Vatican territory, which is all that, of course, that remains today of the Pope's earthly kingdom. And so at the same year that his spiritual authority, the Pope's spiritual authority, is established with the declaration of papal infallibility, he also loses his temporal authority, loses his geographical territory of the papal states. Well, Pope Pius IX, this great pope who establishes all of this, dies in 1878, and he's succeeded by Pope Leo XIII. Pope Leo XIII, as I've said, is a conservative as well, and but he has a friendlier face. And Pope Leo XIII is the one we have to thank for the social doctrine of the Church. He wrote the encyclical Rerum Novarum. And Rerum Novarum tries to address the social teachings of the Church. Now, the social problems of the age. Now, this is really interesting because, as I said, part of the a strand of liberalism in the Church was a political and economic strand, standing up for the poor, standing up for the rights of man, standing up for freedom of expression, for freedom of worship. And for the freedom of the common man. And Pope Leo XIII's teaching about the social doctrine of the Church is the first document which begins to recognize the good aspects of the liberal movement, but embraces them as a pastoral initiative rather than a doctrinal or philosophical initiative. So Pope Leo XIII is able to go through and say, well, look, you know, the aspects of freedom for the ordinary man, the aspects of freedom to form labor unions, the defense of the poor, is an important aspect of our understanding as Catholics. But this doesn't necessarily mean that we have to go along with the philosophical roots of liberalism. And therefore, Pope Leo XIII is able to take us into the modern age with a concern for the poor, with a concern for human rights, with a concern for the needs of the poor. Remember, it's during this time period as well that the Industrial Revolution has brought huge numbers of people into the burgeoning cities all across Europe. And at the same time, there was a huge increase in the population of Europe. And so in the slums, where there were such terrible conditions, where people were living in absolute poverty, spending most of the pitiful wages they're earning in the factories just on a few potatoes and cabbage to try to have a mouthful to eat, where if they got sick, they would be fired and they would starve. Pope Leo XIII, in his encyclical Rerum Novarum, establishes the rights of workers against the tyrannical factory owners and the men of big business who were dominating the poor and abusing the poor. And as he does so, he sets the stage for the modern age in which the good aspects of liberalism. Are actually brought out and highlighted so that they can accept helping the poor and the freedom of individuals and the freedom of speech and so forth without necessarily embracing the philosophical. Why does this matter? Because the events of the 19th century influence where we are in the Church today. The same struggle between liberalism and between the historic Christian faith is one which we have in the Church today. And remember, liberalism is typified by two underlying philosophies. First of all, an anti-supernaturalism, that we can't believe anything supernatural, that what you see is what you get, materialism, the natural world is all you have, and also, along with this, religious indifferentism. It doesn't really matter what religion you follow, as long as you follow your truth. Along with that goes relativism and utilitarianism, all the aspects of the modernistic world and the modernistic religion, which is being foisted on us as a false religion. Standing against this is historic classical Christianity, historical Catholicism, which says the old story is the story of a sinful humanity in need of a redeemer and the supernatural incarnation of God's Son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that we might be freed from the law of just a human religion. And this conflict is still with us. It began, of course, back in the 17th, 18th century. Continued into the 19th century with the full flowering of liberalism and modernism, and Pope Pius IX stands up against it. We'll see the conflict continues through the 20th century and then into our own age. the other aspect of the 19th century religion, which is so important, is the influence of the Pope and the dominance of the Pope. It's interesting for us to remember that this is really comparatively recent in the Church. It was during Pius IX's papacy, for instance, that suddenly reproductions of the image of the Pope could be circulated and printed and sent all over the world as prayer cards and so forth. And the Pope as this dominant infallible figure, standing for the figurehead of the whole Catholic faith, and this global figure began to emerge. It's something we take for granted, but it's something which is comparatively recent. And it also brings about a debate. What is the limit of the Pope's power? What can the Pope do? What can he not do? How much does the loyalty to the Pope demand of us today, when some of us don't really agree with the present Pope or don't like the present Pope, if that's your situation? These questions are live questions which are given to us by the 19th century and the events of the 19th century. Well, I hope you'll continue to listen. We're going to do one more session on the momentous events of the 20th century, Fatima, two world wars, the Second Vatican Council, and then one session bringing us where we are today and what the future church looks like. After this series, Triumphs and Tragedies, is over, it'll be available on my blog. I'll also be starting a new history podcast, which is called Characters of the Reformation, which will be based on Hilaire Belloc's classic book. I'll be reading the book in an abridged version and commenting on each chapter as we go, so that we can spend more time exploring the fascinating 16th century and the history of the Reformation. Remember, I also have the podcast Stories of the Unexpected, which tells and reflects on different supernatural events that have happened in my life and the life of my family and friends. That's on my website, dwightlongenecker.com. I'm also starting up a new podcast called True Fairy Tales, in which I just simply tell stories which will be have meaning and have depth and have some symbolism, so that you can listen to them and share them with your kids and your grandkids. Thanks for listening. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.